Hello and welcome to Hillstrom OT Cyber Chats, the podcast where we spotlight the people and ideas driving progress in operational technology cybersecurity. Each episode, our host, Hillstrom's own CEO, Roger Hill, sits down with fellow industry experts to share real-world insights, practical strategies, and the lessons they've learned through years of experience. If you're looking for grounded conversations that go beyond the buzzwords and into what actually works, well, you're in the right place. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Hillstrom's OT Cyber Podcast. So my name is Roger Hill. Really glad you all can join us here today. I'm really excited to have this conversation with an old friend of mine, Marco Ayala. And Marco, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Roger. Pleasure to be here with you. Thanks for having me on. Really excited to talk to you. And yes, we do definitely have a history, especially in this field. So it's great to be on.
Yeah. Jokingly, we kind of think about the major event timeline in OT security. It's either pre-Stuxnet, post-Stuxnet. You and I go back pre-Stuxnet. I was kind of thinking earlier. I remember you were part of the systems engineering group with the process side in Springhouse. I was on the discrete side with systems engineering. We got together in Springhouse, Pennsylvania, and I think it was around 2009-ish.
So we met in 2009, but around 2010, 2011, yeah. 2011 is when we actually were in Springhouse together. But
oh, was it? Yeah, okay, okay.
You're pretty spot on. And you know what, Roger? That was before it was even coined OT, operational right. technology.
Yeah,
so, yeah. We definitely go back. And honestly, I remember that time quite well, because some of the things that you were working on were very inspirational from a vendor perspective at the time. And I thought it was really game changing for the type of things that we're seeing now, but even more so at that time per se. So good stuff. Thanks for having me.
Interesting
on.
Journey, right? So, hey, listen, let's kick it off. So Marco, let's start with in you giving an introduction of yourself, what you're, and part of that, give a little bit of a flavor of your journey.
Time do we have? Roger, I started out in electronics and moved my way up and through instrumentation and electrical, which then got me into the journey of, programmable systems, PLCs, PAC controllers, process automation controllers, which also got me the introduction into like the more products, which eventually became Siemens. Yeah. We had at the plant. So I started my career as an asset owner just not run of the mill. But, we had a lot of different diverse systems. And so I was able to cut my teeth on many different vendor systems that were just not only within our business unit, but across other business units.
Yeah.
So my journey really stemmed from there, and then I got into distributed control systems and then into safety instrumented systems and burner management, flame safeguard systems. But where I really started the journey into the cybersecurity front was by incident. I had inherited, since I was also on the programming side, the actual, site historian and for many of the other historians in the U.S., but not being able to get to those systems due to an internal incident was kind of in my journey of how to become a cybersecurity person. So I actually started out my career more on the control side, automation side, which then fell in. So this was pre-CFATS, chemical facility anti-terrorism.
Sure.
So started my journey, was an early adopter of technology and doing defense in depth strategy. Mm-hmm. Network segmentation and deploying out kit. So right around the CFATS time, that's really where I started even to get more involved within the federal space, working with Department of Homeland Security and also being a person that was part of the team from the asset owner side that was on the American Chemistry Council, their ITC, mm-hmm. and just stemmed from there. So it's been a long ride. I want to say I've been in the industry 30 years, starting in the specialty gases and chemical, and then moving over into oil and gas and maritime. But, but through that journey from asset owner to vendor, working with you at that small delta in time, and then going to the consulting world, only to go complete full circle, which I always said I would end up back at the asset owner, which I did. I actually went back into mining and refining, which is an interesting industry all by itself. And I can tell you now I'm working more on the federal side, supporting, you know, government type work, things of that nature, and just really excited. But one of the key things that I've in my journey is I've always been connected to the International Society of Automation. So recently this year, I was nominated in and voted in as an ISA fellow, which.
Congrats, by the way. Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, for me, when I first started out my journey in the early 2000s, 2002 was when I actually initially joined ISA. That was to take a class from Paul Gruen on process safety. Yeah. And so it's really stemmed, but I thought at that time, wouldn't it be really cool to be one day, you know, giving back and donating time, you know, whether it's standards or training curriculum, to one day become a fellow. And honestly, I'm quite humbled from that really, really excited about it. But Roger, I guess the other thing too is that I care so much about the U.S. and the nation, obviously our allied partners. One of the things that I've donated some of my time to is becoming an InfraGuard member. So InfraGuard is a partnership with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So I went from, you know, member to sector chief for maritime, covering offshore Gulf of Mexico, now Gulf of America, to you know, now the president of second largest chapter in the U.S. And I'm just really humbled. And I know that was a long journey around, but it's been, you know,
I think your passion's always been there, hasn't it?
I come from the field, you know, I get dressed up every now and again, but I really feel at home in my fire retardant, my hard hat, and my safeties. it's just where I cut my teeth. But you know, there's a lot of things that can be gained and earned, especially in the boardrooms, is working with folks that may not have that field expertise, but trying to translate risk to them to understand, I think is helpful. And guys like yourself, myself, and many others in our industry are key to getting that messaging across, especially when it comes to industrial control systems.
So that's an interesting, let's pull that thread a little bit in terms of messaging. So let's kind of go back in time. I know thinking around that post-Stuxnet time period, you know, that absolutely changed the trajectory of my career. And having worked in so many verticals, I know I was personally motivated to take hacking control systems off the table. That was my, you know, personal mission, because the idea, I remember when we first we're seeing Stuxnet, just the idea that somebody would do this intentionally, it's like, why would you do this? that's when we think about the system test back then, it was literally a system test case that wasn't even considered of somebody intentionally trying to do this, right? So, you know, that's where I was, oh, wow, you know, thinking about the architecture and the systems, it was scary times, right? And I know, like so many others, at that time period, I came out of that thinking, oh, wow, there's going to be a wave of attacks. It's imperative. We have to act. We have to act now. And maybe the future didn't actually turn out the way I thought, you know, maybe back then, which is a good thing, though, by the way. But this is where I really maintain that it's so interesting, the journey that an individual takes. Part of my journey was, of course, building out that business at Siemens and working in some of the early verticals, early adopters, such as chemical. Then going to the power side with, you know, industrial SDN, but then back to Rockwell Automation, focusing on the product security. All of that gives you different perspectives or different lenses into the same problem set, if you will, until ultimately it was a large, you know, global MSSP. Where I've kind of landed in my personal journey is it's really interesting when you look at, for example, the manufacturing sector, Marco. And that's maybe one of the areas where maybe I'm a little more passionate about now, because I do see manufacturing as being in a greater need, because earlier in that post-Stuxnet, when we did the early market validation, you know, the manufacturing sector is, yeah, we're not convinced China and Russia were out to get them. And you know what? They were right. Bottom line. So, you know, we found chemical to be one of the early adopting segments, you know, and so that was a, you know, the process space in general, right? Which you know very well. But I think looking at the manufacturing sector now with ransomware having targeted, but one thing that's really interesting, I'm going to pose this as a question for you, is when you look at the last 12, 18 months of ransomware, 70% or greater of those impacts to the loss of production never made it south of that industrial DMZ. It's the indirect, and that is a focus area and something I, because I feel like it's at that intersect point between building control system cybersecurity, industrial control system cybersecurity, and InfoSec. And then what we're doing today, Marco, think about our community. We focus on that industrial DMZ and south. Anything else is out of scope. But so no one's really addressing the intersect. I'm going to stop talking for a second. Got to get your thoughts on this.
It's great. It's great that you're bringing a lot of this up, because I've been very vocal on, you know, especially integrating enterprise systems and MES and SAP, and you can just start naming off all the technology, what have you. And I can tell you that you don't have to have a direct hit on your industrial control systems. You can now just come in from the enterprise side, impact SAP. You can change things or modify things that could impact operations, or just make the actual mission assure questionable enough to where you just isolate and shut down. And so, and I've seen this. I've seen this historically where people are bringing data out of the control system environment, getting it out of the IDMZ, getting it up into enterprise, and then someone wanting to bring in market shares, pricing, and what have you, and then push it all the way back down in real-time optimization, all the way back through the way down into the DCS or distributed control system. And it's like, man, there's just so much room for modification changes and that blind reliance on the technology. So when we started to see SCADA systems use the term enterprise SCADA, you know, many years ago, that's when we started to see this complete digital ecosystem of total integrated architecture, or as one vendor likes to call it, but many of the other vendors are very similarly calling that connectivity the same way. And if you've noticed, Roger, especially the last 5 years with IoT and IIoT, mm-hmm. now there's really no Purdue level separation. Folks are wanting to talk L4 right down to L2 or even L1 in many instances. Yeah. And so that's fine. I don't own your risk, but there's a lot of questions around the technologies and the security from that aspect, not just to mention the process safety or the impacts to your operational environment for your operators. So those are some of the things that I also look at, and you're right. These could have impacts to that.
I know there's a few voices in our community, let's say, that you know, they'll take that hard, strident position of, well, that wasn't an attack on the industrial control system. I'm sorry, but a hacker is like any other software developer, and I'm a software developer, so I can state this, we're lazy. We're only going to do what we need to do in order to accomplish the mission. And if I don't have to make it onto the process control network and control system network to accomplish the mission, you're financially motivated. It's just a ridiculous position. Did we disrupt the mission? Because your mission is to produce a product, transport that product to a point of sale, and sell that product. That everything else that exists in your company is in support of part of that mission.
Definitely. From the enterprise side, if you can get to the enterprise and cause impacts or disruptions that could cause, you know, batches or other things to be crippled. And so that may be your intention or effect, or from a cyber actor criminal that is looking for monetary gain. They don't even care what their target is as long as you're paying up. And that's also problematic. And we've seen that where these actors actually target schools and also target hospitals in manufacturing, and obviously now they're spinning over and looking in aviation. So it's just, you know, when you look at this, and I remember there was a gentleman from MIT many years ago, Dr. David Clark, and he said, you know, if you would have asked us back then, if we would have connected, you know, every system to the internet, to a public network, you know, there might be 10,000 needed machines at that time. 10,000 devices now is basically just a city, not even a city block, just one building. So, but when they looked, when you look at, you know, critical infrastructure, writing public infrastructure, regardless if you're encrypting, virtual this and private network that, even Dr. David Clark stated that, you know, we just wouldn't do that. We just wouldn't ride critical infrastructure over a public network. We just wouldn't do it. So I think we missed some messaging there, some engineering things. And the one that keeps me up at night, though, Roger, is in 2017, you know, with the first safety system targeted malware. That's the big wake up call for me, especially with my passion around process safety and safety instrumented systems.
Yeah.
That being your final last ditch effort prior to your passive and your active release. That's a big deal. And I think industry listened, we learned, but we didn't trigger any new engineering security or safety practices. I think we have an opportunity here in the next 3 to 5 years to be cautious, especially anything around safety. Maybe look at maybe publishing some new documents from maybe the American Institute of Chemical Engineers or the Global Congress on Process Safety on securing those systems. Because many companies from PHAs, HAZOPs, and LOPAs are taking credit of the functionalities of those systems, reducing their risk. And if they're not available, or if they're manipulated or degraded, that could be a bad thing. And so we don't want that. No one wants that.
I think completely agree. And especially in some of the critical industries, I think there's the needed processes around some of the engineering disciplines. And that's really what you're talking about there that really need to be in place when you're looking at some type of an OpEx, a refresh of the process so that we're designing these systems correctly. And one of the things that I was in the early days at Siemens building out the program that was frustrating to me when we were in that first wave, which I call the evangelism wave, right? So in that evangelism wave, we were making some progress in raising awareness, right? But then what was happening is once a potential project went into procurement, all the procurement language and procurement processes were just lowest bid and excluding security. Well, I think we're starting to address that now.
There's still projects that are being deployed out post SAT that the security is half baked. It wasn't baked into the project at the very beginning, or it was sold, but no one was there for a cyber FAT or security FAT. And then to even see if there was a delta at SAT. And that's another thing that I've talked about over the years is making sure that you have a plan, a cyber requirement specification for your control systems, for your OT space. And make sure that you have some form of checkout at FAT and look for deltas at your site acceptance testing, because I've seen it, I've witnessed it. SAT could be a completely different team, different group, and there are changes that have been noticed.
But see, that's an indicator of progress right there. The fact that there is an acronym SAT. Because remember, we didn't used to have that, so that's actually progress.
Well, yeah. So I think there's a lot of value there. Going back to your discussion around the ransomware stuff, it's still an issue. And we look at this from InfraGuard and the FBI perspective is that, you know, could this be dual faceted or even triple faceted, these events where they come in, they hit a company's enterprise, hold them hostage, they get the ransom, but is it possible that they could also be seeding for another command and control later that could be staged somewhere? So eradicating these threat actors is really important, and understanding, you know, how far, how deep, and how wide they went into your infrastructure in case there is some other secondary or tertiary thing that is deployed out in your infrastructure that may be completely invisible to you. And that's why I like the standards-based approach of defense-in-depth strategies, zones, conduits, risk assessment, is really looking at segmentation, defining out your zones, conduits, but it's really important to understand if you are impacted, how can you isolate if needed, and what those risks look like. So it's a journey, man. And you know that, Roger. Yeah. It's all about life cycle. It truly is. And I think we are getting better, but at the same time as we're trying to get better and catch up, we're deploying new technology, new things into the environment that to me should be even more vetted before we fully adopt it in. And there's a lot of technologies, artificial intelligence. Now people are talking quantum in the next by 2030, even. We've got technology on transmitters that is expanding out to where it's not just 4 to 20 hard anymore. So we're just, we're pushing the envelope as humans. And at the same time, we're trying to patch and update and do all these other things after the fact. And the standards, as you know, usually roll in after deployment, as opposed to leading indicator, as opposed to a lagging. And so those are things that also are important to me, is really looking at this thoroughly and deeply. Even these ransomware outbreaks, mm-hmm. is determining what you have within your systems, and can you determine if there's been any modifications or changes at the lower levels. And I can say that there's companies that are really strong for looking at anything below L3. And there's some that once it's below L3, it's not really tracked or monitored as well as it should.
You mentioned what was kind of a driving passion for you. For example, thinking back to the Tricomics and the safety systems and your background there, right? One thing that really hit home for me that I was reading on X, I think. And I hate this, but I can't remember the name of the company. I want to say it was a German company within the last 2 weeks where essentially it was a ransomware event and that manufacturer had to shut their doors. They're out of business now.
Completely out of business.
Yeah. So to me, that gets me because might be because I'm in a small business myself, right? But the idea though is the impact of people having to shut their doors. People are out of work now because of this. This is where I really would like to take that off the table. And I think this is what's unique when you look at the manufacturing sector versus some of the other critical infrastructure, because when you look at utilities, whether it's power, water treatment, and then some of the chemical, I think your adversaries and the motivations, slightly different, right? I think when we're looking at manufacturing, it's a much more narrower scope of the financial gains of ransomware, clearly number one, from an external threat. There's still the insider non-malicious, right? But I think outside of that, it's really just industrial espionage, that sort of thing.
The insider threat is still really, really a big percentage.
Yeah, seriously. But I think looking at the external one is definitely ransomware. And one of the things that I think is kind of the epiphany moment for me, right, is what a manufacturer can do to actually decrease their risk the most. And it's on the carpeted side of the house. It's not on the concrete side. And that's because what I maintain is that 95% or greater of your threats are really from that IT to OT. Your other 5% is personnel, and it's at the edge, right? It's the integrators, solution partners. It's the, that's so what you can actually do is on the carpeted side. Anyway, let me get ahead, throw that out to you and see what you think there, if you're in agreement or.
How they secure their own fence lines and their own products and things. So, I'm in agreement there. Having partners, especially in this, and collaboration is going to be key in securing your mission, securing your sites. One of the key aspects of this, and it dovetails into what you were just saying, is that especially when it comes to, you know, the manufacturing sites. Very, very important that you're in lockstep, trying to do the best you can, and making sure that you're following some best practices. And the reality is that we have to have partnerships in place and good consulting and things of that nature. So that's why I've always said that you can't, it's definitely a team sport from the IT side. And you're right. You know, we put a lot of time and money and experience onto the IT premise. And a lot of that's coming in through even user action, you know, the phishing, you know, just the simple things that these threat actors are utilizing to get down into the systems. And I think that's not going to go away. I think if anything, especially with AI, we've seen this actually expand out, and they've gotten really better at even crafting some of the social engineering that goes into these, that it's even able to spoof a lot of the actual out of the box Microsoft stuff that is supposed to be advanced. So left hand, right hand, good, bad, it's going to continue. So my point there is Roger, is you got to start somewhere, right? And you got to make sure that you're following through, and whatever if you're following standards or if you're under regulatory burden, then, you know, it's important that you have a plan and a practice in place for your facilities.
So what are your thoughts of, you know, and listen, you know, my roots of kind of really starting with OTSOC. What are your thoughts on the separation of an OTSOC from an enterprise SOC? And
I was just given some training in Belgium, and this also came up in the IC32 class. And there was some really good heated but also great discussions around it, that everybody agreed that there should be a security operations center, bringing in the data, aggregating the data, and having folks that are trained, enabled, and knowledgeable. And that was the key differentiator, is that although IT has an ability to actually have, you know, an idea of the IT side, and they can, you know, have playbooks and run back, the playbooks for the OT is quite different. And so the output of that discussion was having an OT SOC can be beneficial to those companies that feel the need of having someone that's in charge and maybe separated for that. But there's some buyer beware, making sure that an OT SOC is truly staffed with OT people that actually have knowledge, discipline, training, factory training, Siemens, Rockwells of the world, you know, have a knowledge of the protocols, but also go a step further and understand the processes at facilities. And I think that's a big piece, because some of the folks in the class had said, well, we tried an OT SOC, but we just found out they were just IT people with an OT naming. And so, and unfortunately incidents happened and they were able to determine that out. So it's not for everyone. I personally think that if I had a dedicated, you know, a group that was focused on OT, and I was able to view their actual resumes, their technical resumes and their technical chops, I would feel more comfortable having that OT SOC specific to my operations if I was the director of ops, looking over that, as opposed to just an IT infrastructure security operations center. And nothing against the IT folks.
Yeah,
they're very, very good at what they do. It's just when you ask them, hey, do you want to be responsible for life and limb and loss of containment? They'll say, you know, that's a completely different skill set. And if we miss it, will that be on us? And a lot of the time, the answer is we don't want that on our backs, you know. And so, again, I always go back to the process safety side. If I'm going to have an angel sitting on my shoulder watching my process for me, I feel a lot more comfortable with folks at an operations center that have that cybersecurity background, but are very versed in PCS7, very versed in Honeywell, Experion, very versed in. And so for me personally, I would go with an OT SOC. Yeah. Have it still maybe within the umbrella of that main SOC, but have specific members that are focused directly on it. But give me the ability to pick and choose the resumes that are going to be watching over my fortress or watching over my, what's important to me if I was the asset owner for that industry. So for me, it depends. But that was some of the discussions that came out of it. There were some that were like, no, IT, we'll stick with it. We've got pricing constraints. Great. And then those that actually had issues going with an OT SOC that they really didn't know the OT side. And that's some buyer beware.
It's an interesting problem. And this is a really interesting one for me personally, because my journey has almost done a 180 there, because I've always has, you know, had that very strong proponent of an OT SOC. But where I've kind of landed on is, number one, first of all, where I'm at now is I believe an OT SOC has to be part of an enterprise SOC as a subset.
Agreed. And that's where I was going with that. It's got to be integrated.
It does, because otherwise you lose all situational awareness. At the end of the day, to look at this in the most simplistic terms, right? The entire mission of a SOC is to identify threats as they were landing on your enterprise. And as they're trying to traverse your business functions, whether that's finance, R&D, quality, guess what? Operations is just another business function at the end of the day. I'm an old OT guy, so I can get away with saying that. But at the end of the day, that's the reality. So if you have that completely separated, and then the technologies and the early warning sensors you have are literally at level 3.5 or below, you've lost all early warning and you've lost all shared situational awareness with your enterprise. And that to me is critical. And that's number one. How I've kind of jokingly always talked about the difference is that there's three differences between a tier one, tier two analyst on the OT side versus IT. Context, 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 you know, gets the point across. Where I've kind of landed now though, is that if we think about the triage and investigation from the disciplines and the skill set required, there's not a difference in the skill set, because what you're really doing is you're doing literally forensics and data evaluation on the same type of compute systems, right? What if we separate your playbooks and your response side? Where I've kind of landed now is I just need the IR tier one and tier two operators that now what I can do is I can extend the life cycle within my SOC of I can go tier one, tier two, so forth on the enterprise, and then rotate into my OT as a specialized role, tier one, tier two. Now I've doubled my life cycle of my personnel, because your biggest loss of skill resources there is simply you have what about an 18-month window, generally speaking, because these people get bored. They're driven not just by salaries, it's intellectual stimulation. And there's one common denominator I've always seen with an analyst within a SOC is they are fascinated with the physical world, with things that go boom. They just nothing but questions. You know, because knocking down an exchange email server, I'm sorry, that's boring compared to, you know, some things that happen in our world. So it's just fascinating to them. They're intellectually stimulated. So I think that's kind of where I've kind of evolved. But one of the biggest takeaways I had, Marco, and this kind of goes back to something I mentioned a little bit earlier, is the reality of the measures that you are taking on the enterprise side. And this is especially true for a manufacturer. And the better you are identifying threats and containing threats on that enterprise, it has a direct correlation to the number of actual events I'm seeing on the OT side. Because the reality is, when I would do those QBRs on the OT side, I didn't have the number of events to work with. And the value story would start to fall apart. Right. So having it separated doesn't make as much sense to me now. So it's about, I've maybe it's something to do with age, but I view the world so pragmatic now.
Right? you and I are definitely not getting any younger there, Roger. So, but Yeah, I can see your point on your approach and your thinking, how it's kind of melded that direction. I can see your point there, and I could say there's going to be opportunity for cross training as well from the OT side to the IT side for those that are inquisitive and would like to know more about the cyber physical piece of it and the, you know, what that all means. I can see value with that.
Now, the other side of this that I think is really complicated is when you think about a global manufacturer that has 100, 200 sites, Marco, you and I both know that probably 30% came through acquisition, right?
I've lived it.
Exactly. So you know in certain regions, you're going to have predominant Siemens systems, you're going to have Schneider, you're going to have all different sorts of architectures. This is my fundamental problem with the idea of having direct OT expertise in that SOC. I think it's really fictional to think that they can understand all the different process architectures. So what's a next alternative solution? And to me, it's almost like an internal crowdsourcing capability, right? So give me the expert that can quickly identify a threat, go through triage and start to investigate this, have enough context where they're able to integrate. Oh, okay. I know I have a mapping of all of my OT SMEs for all of these different sites. Right. And I have site, you know, in Frankfurt,
it goes back to your umbrella scenario. In other words, still ground. Having your IT SOC, still having that's that, exactly. Looking at the threat intel, looking at all the possibilities, yeah. Then having the OT side as your champions internally. There you go. So that's fair.
It's in the same way. It's actually in the same vein of one of the things that I think is the most important thing to do when you're building out a program, if you're early in your journey, is starting with that Steerco advisory, corporate advisory, whatever we want to call that, where we're staffing the different OT security and IT security domains into a team environment where you're starting to get that cross-pollination. It's that same thing. We have to break down these silos.
Yeah, I think that's and I think there are companies that are going that route. Some have their own internal SOCs and they divvy things up and they have their own, you know, bad actors, internal, you know, type you know, cornering and what have you. So there's companies that are very mature and there's some that are small that may not be mature that are just getting visibility into their networks that, you know, are going to, you know, send it up to a SOC that may be doing both. So I'm definitely a fan of that, Roger. But going back to our automation side, that, you know, if you're a lead over a global operation, you should be, your role is to understand and know not only the configurations but the systems at all the sites that are underneath your umbrella, because that is your role as a manager or as a director and a technical lead. To be able to know, regardless of what country it is, if it's vendor A, vendor B, vendor C, or some weird off-baked, made in Asia, whatever, vendor D that's out there, that's your responsibility. And having folks in your OT group that are helping you on your day-to-day network mission.
It takes a village.
It takes absolutely.
It really does. Yeah. Completely agree. And I think that's where we're kind of evolving to. So we brought up a couple of times, you know, we've hinted around AI. Let me just kind of throw that one out. What are your thoughts and what are you doing maybe around AI, or what do you see happening in the market?
There's a lot of folks in our industry and definitely in our OT discipline that also are using AI and talking about AI in OT. And I think you should value that. And I think you should also be very, very careful in deploying out technology that may be half-baked or not fully known of, especially down into the control system area where, you know, there could be read-write capabilities. And my concern is that when the head lady of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT Dr. Daniela Ross. She was on CBS on Nova. You could watch that episode. She actually stated that they're still trying to figure out how the output gets to what it is, and so that people need to be much more thorough in determining how it got to that output before putting it into a live environment. And I want to stress that that's not me saying it. That's the head lady of MIT's artificial intelligence lab saying to do that. So I'm just saying, follow her advice before you just, you know, deploy out technology that you may not know why that control valve closed on you when it should never close. I'm not saying that maybe AI did it, but if you deploy these things out without fully vetting them and really testing and understanding how these things get to their output, you know, that's your risk, not mine. You know, the thing, Rogers, we've been doing real-time optimization, model predictive control, fuzzy, neural. We've been doing that for some time. We've gotten really good at it. And now we've got this new shiny object, you know, that's out there. And I'm all for it. If you can do it and you can demonstrate that, you know, it can be done safely, securely, and that you have some form of mechanical stops or something to be able to isolate technology from taking over your plant environment, then that would be my request to you, is documenting that out. Because as you know, especially from a control algorithms perspective, is that we as control engineers, we know what we're trying to get an output to do. And now we're bringing in something that may not be completely easy for us to dissect, to be able to understand. So I think AI is great, especially, you know, the contextual side, taking things like operator logs, maybe summarizing them. I think there's a lot of great value there, especially in alarm rationalization, things of that nature. Yes, we should be adopting it. So I am a fan of it. I don't want anybody to listen to the podcast and say, oh, Marco said it, he hates AI. That's not it. I'm just saying we need to balance it. We need to balance the technology. Do you really need it? You know, if the old saying is, you know, a pound of water into a boiler, you're hoping to get a pound of steam out, right? And you might be 80%, 85, 86% there, you know, within, you know, your actual realization of a pound of water in or a pound of steam out. Is AI going to get you that 87%? Is it really going to do that? Is your model predictive already doing the best that it can now? And if the value answer is no, not really, you can't get more through the pipe than what that pump will put out, then why even go down the journey of AI for the sake of just saying you're doing it? That's my only point. Yeah. So if you've got real mechanical process piping constraints, there's no amount of AI that's going to get you more product in the pipe if that pipe could actually handle. That's my only perspective.
So I think there's a, I definitely agree with that. I think when I think about AI, the part that frustrated me early on, early on meaning just like 18 months ago, right? But what would frustrate me is all the hype around AI. And it personally frustrated me because I'm like, what are you calling AI? Because people started to lump machine learning, supervised, all into this one magical, mythical AI bucket. And I found that to be so frustrating, but it was, you know what? I've had that experience so many times in my career where, well, I remember the first time I was in a meeting where somebody used the term OT to describe me. I never heard of it, right? So I was slow to get on that board. I was slow to get on I might be slow, but I get there, right? So I think AI is another example.
Plant manager back in the day, his name was Bob Lucas. If you said OT, he knew it was overtime, and he hated that word. He's like, "Oh, so, we're not doing OT." I'm like, "Well, it's overtime."
So I think what's interesting. So I think if you focus on the definition of what you mean by AI, and break down the different types of AI, now what you can do is you can start to think through different use cases where you can actually leverage this. I think at the end of the day, one thing I think we all have to admit is the force multiplier nature of AI. And maybe one of the nuggets, and I think this is one of the few things that I could state, I feel like it's the people in our generation and our level of experience in our field that we have such an advantage over the ones that are just breaking into the field. Because I remember, I don't know if you remember your first experience going into maybe like a ChatGPT or something, but I did what I knew, right? I started asking questions about my area of expertise. And I still remember that first experience I had, Marco, where some of the responses coming back, and I'm like, wait a second, that's how I talk about this. And I really thought in my mind that I had some really unique approaches. I'm like, where did you get this information, right? And like 90%, it was like really, really good. But at 10%, I'm like, oh, okay, no, that's just pure IT. And that's where I had my very first epiphany. And that is, us gray hairs, we have a distinct advantage. We can immediately tell 90% of that is fantastic. I can use it. 10%, no, needs some work. Where with the younger generation, it's binary. It's good or bad, right? So that's our strategic advantage, number one. And that's just on the large language model, generative models. I think when you start thinking about these different use cases, then I think it becomes very interesting. I think the reliance into an area where, you know, it's our world, consulting. I think right now, what I've seen within the market, there's been a lot of pressure because of the economy and many other factors of people not hiring and putting more onus on the few resources. Everyone I talk to, they're just underwater, Marco. They've got open recs that they're not filling, and they're just, but the amount of work, they have to just increase their throughput. So that's where I think there's many organizations starting to lean more heavily upon AI. The hallucinations are absolutely real.
They very are real. So they are absolutely real.
Maintaining the human of the loop is just absolutely crucial.
And model manipulation, right? And so that's another one. So I think Mr. Musk just realized that yesterday with his platform with Grok, where it was actually starting to provide.
That's a different podcast.
which actually started to provide, and I won't get into the details, but provided some very scary output messaging, right? So. Yeah.
And we'll leave it there.
We'll leave it there. But the point there is that in a closed environment, if it's localized and you're feeding it and you're containing it and controlling it, it's not out there in some cloud and, you know, where it could have some artificial inconnects, then either tainting or modifying or growing your knowledge base without your knowledge, you know, those are some of the things you have to just be cognizant of.
Have you had much opportunity to play around with the agentic RAG, the retrieval augmented generation? No. So that I think is very promising in our world, right? So I'll boil it down to some very specific use cases, right? When we're looking at putting together some program documents, right? Whether it's policy, process, SOPs, whatever the case may be, and we're aligning to a standard, whether that's a NIST CSF 882, you know, 62443-3, whatever the case may be, we can take that standard or framework and we can take that retrieval augmentation, take that and you store it into like a vector database. Like one that I play with is Pinecone. So what you're dealing with then is a set retrieval that you're actually querying against, instead of the large general purpose training that happened with the LLM. Now what you're doing is you're querying against this RAG. So now you've controlled the response, if you will. So if you think about our somewhat predictable world, that actually makes a lot of sense now, because now I can leverage this to get much more predictable. And guess what that does? That reduces hallucinations, right? So
I like that. You call it, what did you call it? Pinecone?
Agentic RAG. So it's retrieval augmented generation. So there's this notion of, so not getting too weeny area here, but there's different forms. Like you can take working off this, what's called the chunks and embeddings, right? So you can search the standards database for maybe like a 3-3 standard, right? Where what you can do then is take the work in chunks, which could maybe be like a sentence or two, maybe such as a requirement, right? Standard requirement. And then what you do is you take this, what's the embeddings, which might be just like 3 or 4 words from that. What you can say is access control for PLC, right? And you could say access control for DLC. And what you have in this vector database, it literally is it's a floating point number that you assign as part of the training on these embeddings where you say, yeah, the access control for PLC and access control for DCS, that is like a 0.1 apart. They're very close. But now what you do is if you start working on the inverse of what are very far apart from a floating point number, if they're not related. So that's what the retrieval is actually doing, is it's using a graph then to determine, you know, the relationship, what's similar, what's dissimilar. But that it's a real basic premise. But then you can go into the next level of depth into the actual instructions and prompts. But I think that's where the